This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. I intended to bring you a show this week about my recent travels to Amsterdam. Instead, I'm traveling to Florida. When I booked the trip earlier this week, I thought I was going home to see my dad for the last time, to be with family during hard times, and possibly attend his funeral. Instead, I'm going for the funeral. My dad, Edward Robert Billings, died on the morning of April 2nd. His sometimes nickname is Eddie Joe Bullet. Where he got that name, I don't know. It predated me. But I like it, and I tend to call him that when I think of how fun, and how simply silly he can be. This Yin Radio show is dedicated to him, to Eddie Joe Bullet. It features segments about dads, and loss, and life. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is Eddie Joe Bullet. Installment number one, Storyteller. It features my dad, Ed Billings, and a conversation I had with him in 2007. In my family, storytelling is a polite word for lying, for just plain making stuff up. And so when I say my dad's a storyteller, I mean he makes up stuff. He's always done it. He used to tell us the same lies, the kind you tell little kids and you laugh because they're gullible enough to believe you. And as we grew up, he kept telling these stories to entertain us. Last summer, I talked to him about his storytelling, and I challenged him.
He told us all kinds of crazy stories that weren't true.
They were true.
What stories?
They were all true.
Yeah, okay, tell me a true story.
A true story. Well,
Well, since his stroke in 1991, he's not as fluid a talker as he once was, but of course that might have been that he was searching for some truth just then. His gift of gab had been noted among his fellow salesmen, however, but he's still quite obstinate.
I don't believe anything. I don't believe you have a true story in you.
I do have a true story. When we were in East St. Louis, Illinois, we were all in absolutely one room. I went into the basement of the place, and there was clothing and all of that. And in there, I was with a boy that was about 14 years old or so.
Okay, Daddy's told this story before, and my sister, Sherry, thinks it's true. And I think Daddy really thinks it's true, too.
And it was dark in there, and I saw footprints up the wall, over the ceiling, into a pit. And I do not know how long that pit was or anything like that. But we got out of there, and I never went into the basement again, I don't believe.
But you lived in that house?
We lived in that house because my granddaddy was a kind of a minister to the people there. And he handed out food and everything to the indigents. And so, but I did not go into that basement again. And in about 2 or 3 weeks, we had left that place and went south to Tallahassee again.
Mm. How old were you?
How old was I? Probably 9 years old, I think. No, I wasn't older. I wasn't that old. I think I was 8.
Okay.
8 years old.
Well, that's Sherry's story, too. Sherry's favorite story of yours.
Oh, really?
My favorite story is the one about the lion in front of the fraternity at FSU.
Oh, good Lord, yes. I tell you, And it's still true. It just grew up.
Now, this story, this is one that we've been told as long as I can remember. There's this life-size plaster lion on the front lawn in one of the fraternities at Florida State University. It's Leo the lion. Now, Leo's gone now, but the family tradition of telling the lion story is a mainstay. See, the frat boys, whose lawn Leo sat on, would dress him up and they'd paint him and decorate him for different occasions. And every Christmas, the lion had a painted-on Santa suit. Every Christmas, since I can remember, our family would go sit on Leo and take pictures. And the story that Dad told us one time, really matter-of-factly, like you're just telling kids history they couldn't know, was that the lion was once a doorstop, little as a kitten. He only got big by being painted over and over, and the paint layers built up until he was so huge that Daddy now has to lift us up onto Leo's back. It took us years to realize that this couldn't be true.
It grew up, and I don't know where they moved that lion, but I tell you, that was a fun lion to be in front of. It was, really. It was just super.
And Sherry has another favorite untrue story.
I know it's true.
About over by the pool, not too far from there, the FSU pool. That's where they make the clouds. That's a cloud factory.
Of course. Of course, I tell you.
Now, this is another of the many Let's Fool the Kids stories that Daddy would tell. He said that the steam rising near the FSU pool from the steam plant was the source of clouds. Now, I never believed that one. It was a lame story. So when he started defending it, before he even knew the story, I knew he was just into obstinate mode right now. So I let it go and just enjoyed the ride.
Everything Sherry said was true, too. No doubt in my mind it's true. It's not for me to say, but it is so true.
Well, and then the last thing I'll ask you about your true stories is Mom said you used to tell us bedtime stories. Do you remember doing that?
Of course, but I don't remember any of them right now.
But you used to make them up.
Oh, good Lord. I tell you, some of them is true, and some of them is a big fabrication.
But I didn't remember that.
Well, I don't either right now. But most of them, I think, was true then.
They were like lion stories.
Yeah.
He does enjoy his lying. And we all do, too. I've never been great at making up stuff like Daddy can. But I don't have to, because I have his stories to repeat and to relive, and my sisters to repeat and relive them with. Now, his abilities always entertain us and make us laugh. And they bring us together in that intimate way that shared histories can. So who really needs truth when stories can give us so much more? Installment number 2, I attended a death. Arlene Falcon told me with eyes shining, I attended a death. She was practically jumping with energy. You could see that she was inspired, joyous, because of her friend's death. I asked her to sit down with me and tell me about it, and she did. She seemed anxious to share her spiritual experience.
It was pretty amazing. It was the first time that I had been, you know, involved at that level with someone dying, and it was an amazing experience.
Brig was a dear friend, and Arlene knew that he was dying of cancer. She left on a Wednesday to be with him. Only a 5-hour drive. By Sunday evening, he was dead, at home, surrounded by loved ones, quietly gone.
When I got there between 2 and 3, I was lucky to feel that he knew I was there, because he wasn't talking anymore. He was pretty much out of consciousness. We were giving him sips of water, and then shortly after that, not even. When I got there, he was actually had his eyes open, but it was one of the last times he had his eyes open. I had to make sure that I knew that he knew that I was there, because we were really close.
Arlene came. Others were already there. More people came. People came and went, bound together by this one man. They didn't all know each other, but they had a common bond. Brig.
The gravity of the situation was, it was intense already. And then we heard, oh, so-and-so was coming, and so-and-so was coming. And later on that evening, a friend, really someone who really loved him dearly, from Oregon, a 12-hour journey, and he came that evening, Wednesday evening, 9 or 10 or so, and he said that when he went into the room, Brig opened his eyes and knew he was there, but, you know, maybe just for a second, just because he heard someone else's voice and realized that there was someone else there. And now this was a guy we didn't even know. A lot of us didn't know. He just, you know, all the different people who cared for this guy showed up, and it was amazing to have that kind of gathering. And we all took vigil in his room. We all took turns spending the night. There was like a 12 to 4 shift, and then like a 4:20 to 8 shift, and then people would get to go to sleep and rest. And we were like this close-knit family all of a sudden. And it was an amazing connection that we all had. And there was not very much we could do, but kind of just be by his side.
Being there changes the way death is perceived. When you visit a deathly ill patient for an hour or so, you're not really there. You're worrying, sad, or just plain uncomfortable with it all. When you sit with the dying, it becomes real. Real life resumes. And real life includes death in all its profound sadness and glory.
Like when I would do a night shift, I had my crossword puzzles and my books. And one time when we had a night shift, there was 2 or 3 of us in the room, and we kind of hung out and tuned into him, and then kind of did our own thing. One time when I did the night shift, I was like, oh no, I fell asleep a little bit, but I felt like I was sleeping along with him, and that he was aware of that, and I held his hand, and I kind of was in and out of sleep also, and I felt like it was okay. He just, you know, just, they say that one of the things about dying is just being, having people there, that, you know, what a sad thing it is to die alone. And he didn't.
The Friday after Arlene arrived at Briggs was a Jewish high holiday, Yom Kippur. Portentous time for death and time for ceremony.
And that's the day that, you know, it's like the gates of heaven are open that day. And it's the day you get written in the Book of Life. And I just felt like, we should do a prayer circle, you know, let's do something and let's hasten this. Let's just open up, you know, get him ready and let's just do a prayer circle. And there was all of us together. And we did that. And it was pretty powerful, but it was so spontaneous. And it was almost like it was the first time that we focusedly sat together like that. And there was 8 or 9 of us by then.
What with Yom Kippur and Briggs' unconscious state, Arlene expected him to pass on Friday. But he held on. When I asked her about how he actually died, she first described the feel each day had. And then, as though time slowed down just before he died, each moment became more focused.
Like, I had my dibs on Friday. made a lot of good sense. And then of course, it didn't happen. And Saturday just felt like a really intense, solemn day. I got to take a lovely walk. It was the last day of summer, and he lives right up a mountain. Like, their land is acreage that goes right up a hill, and he wanted his ashes to be buried up by the first cave and the first layer and landing, and there was some controversy over where that was, and all the guys had gone out hunting for it. It was like a meditative day. It was really like a Sabbath where we just all kind of did our own thing. And then Saturday night passed where he still slept. He was still unconscious. And then Sunday, when we all started paying attention to his energy and we felt something different, you could just feel the energy was just really intense. I was in the room with him and the other guys were outside and we had that energy together. And then Ruthie came in and I was in the room with him and just singing and just praying and chanting, and the energy just felt different. I was feeling really tired. I was thinking of going to take a nap, and by then Ruthie had left and this other guy Greg came in the room, and I looked at Greg and I said, I think I'm gonna go take a nap. I'm just really tired. I just need to go lay down. And I looked at Brig and I said, I better go say goodbye. And I went over to say goodbye, and I just told him I was going to go take a little nap because I was tired, and I just brushed his third eye, and a tear came out, and he stopped breathing. And it was just so powerful. I just looked at Greg, and we just looked at each other, and it was really beautiful. And we just held the energy and looked at each other and just felt relieved. When his rattled, you know, harsh breathing finally slowed and stopped, it felt relief. It didn't feel sad anymore. It was like, finally, he's at peace. And it was a beautiful moment. And it was so empowering for all of us to share that together. And it blew me away.
For the living, death isn't the end of the experience. It's the moment around which everything, the point from which actions and emotions radiate. After Briggs' death, his body was prepared.
And then the next day, the boys had prepared a coffin one day. They realized, how are we going to get him into Spokane? And they went out, Greg's a builder, he went out, they found some supplies, and they made a box for him. And then we brought it into the house the next morning, and we put him in. And then I kind of arranged all his sheets and stuff around him, and we took him into Spokane and had our little funeral procession of four rigs that got lost on the way. You know, we didn't stay all four together, of course. A caravan never works, but we tried. And we all hugged each other and went our own way.
Arlene attended a death. Briggs' death. Is anything more important?
I just knew I had to be there. I just couldn't imagine just being at home, you know, being at my shop working, and I just couldn't. Yeah. You know, it was just there. Sometimes just nothing else is more important than, you know, that being there.
So she was there, and she found new family, new depths, new power. Being there changed Arlene's perspective about death so that even condolences didn't fit.
I've heard that it's empowering, and I would agree. I feel a lot richer and stronger from it, and not as scared of death. It was strange when people would give me condolences and say, "Oh, I'm sorry," and because you just don't feel that. After being there, there's joy. It's not sadness.
I can see why her eyes were shining when Arlene first told me, I just attended a death.
This is Yin Radio. Today's show is in honor and memory of my dad, Ed Billings, who died on Friday, April 2nd, 2010. My dear friend Christy Schwartz shared a memory about her father, who is still alive and kicking. And her dad, Charlie, does in fact remind me a lot of my dad. Here's Christy Schwartz with a question from her childhood.
Daddy, where does water come from? I must have been 7 years old when I asked him this question. He paused and looked up in the air, which meant his answer was going to take a long time to surface. My dad often takes long moments like this, which I found frustrating as a child. To avoid annoyment, I would focus my attention to other things, like owls hooting in the darkness and the cool air on my skin. We always seemed to talk more at night. After a moment, he sighed, looked at me and said, "The earth." I stared back at him as if he was a ghost. Was that really his answer? This was really much more basic than I was expecting. "But how?" I asked. Looking back, I suppose I was expecting something similar to Aldo Leopold's poetic rendition of atom recycling in his essay Odyssey. After all, my dad knew everything. "The earth makes it," he shrugged. I could have again asked, "How does it make it?" But I had been down this road with adults several times. I knew eventually the answer would be something like, "It just does," which in adult language translates as, "Give it up, kid. Forget it." This is something I was never very good at. I suppose I'm still not. I realize what frustrated me most about my dad's answer was the simplicity of it. When I left for college, my water question, and many more like it, still nagged at me. I majored in environmental science, where I was able to learn scientific explanations for natural phenomena. I learned about the water cycle and that the earth, skies, and seas reformat atoms into and out of water molecules on a daily basis. I learned that my dad's answer of the earth creating water was not quite accurate. It doesn't create water, because water has always existed, or at least the oxygen and hydrogen that make up water always have. I learned of theories and tools that attempted to explain the world, like the Big Bang, carbon dating, and evolution.
The clouds get heavy and the rain pours down. Precipitation and more puddles on the ground. Oh, the water cycle round and around. Vapor goes up and the rain comes down.
Science has done a beautiful job in explaining complex situations through modeling and theory. What I learned most during my 4-year degree is that I ended with more questions than I started with. The answers I found in science left my soul with an empty feeling. The answers I found in religion left a bitter taste in my mouth and seemed desperately anthropocentric. My original water question hurled me down a spiritual, metaphysical quest that I have still yet to return from. Where does water come from? I recently realized I have been asking the wrong question for the last couple of decades. My question to my father was really not where does water come from, but why does it form? And in the same matter, why do we humans form? To be able to truly answer where water comes from, where this world comes from, we give a person an ability to answer life's deepest creation questions. What or who created this place? How did it get here? When did it happen? Perhaps it was a little unfair of me to expect my dad to have a thorough answer to the mystical nature of our world without advanced warning. Still, my 7-year-old brain is alive and always questioning, even today. Why do we exist? Why am I here? And a million other why questions that adults love to hear. So Dad, or anyone else that may have an answer, I would love to hear it. Even a simple answer would be a good place to start.
Water circles, water cycles, water dances, watch it spin. As the water coming to us goes around and round again.
In 2007, I recorded this collection of stories about dads from people around town in Moscow, Idaho.
Tell me a story about your dad.
I don't know. Let me think. I remember when he was golfing for the first time and he accidentally swung too hard and he fell on his back. And it was really funny, but I felt bad because he hurt his back. But It was funny.
Where's your dad live?
My parents live in Missouri. My mom actually came and visited me and taught me movies and stuff like that. So.
Cool.
The story starts out that my dad had this really deep voice, like a baritone or a bass speaking voice, very deep. And when I was just learning to walk, I was absolutely terrified of his voice and would not get anywhere near him when he would just simply talk to me like a dad and coax me over. And so my dad, being really concerned, and I guess my mom was too, they went to the pediatrician and explained that they couldn't get me to get near my dad. And, you know, what should they do, and is this normal? And the doctor told them to treat me like a little wild bird or a wild animal and coax me with treats, like you would a dog or a bird, a fish. Yeah, and so my dad would put out butterscotch square See's candy, and he'd put it on the TV tray, and then he'd back away from the TV tray. And I'd come in my walker, just learning to walk, and I'd come snag it and run off. And I wouldn't get near him. And the doctor said, you know, eventually, you know, put it in your hand to get her to take from your hand, like an animal. And so I took it from the TV tray for a while, and he'd put more butterscotch squares out, and then he'd put them in his hand. And so I'd take them from his hand, and then I'd stick around. And then he taught me how to take the little brown wrappy things that they come in and make mustaches and eyebrows out of them. And so that kind of started our father-daughter relationship. And I've always wondered, because to this day, my two favorite candies in the whole world, if I'm really going to treat myself, are butterscotch squares or peanut butter squares from See's Candy. And I wonder, what if he had, like, chosen a really awful candy, like with coconut or orange or something? Would that be my favorite now? I can't imagine. He chose the right candy for me to last a lifetime, because I've never wavered from those two flavors.
Well, the only one that pops into mind is, let's see, I must have been maybe 11 or 12, young teen, which that would make Dad, what if I was 12, would that make him 36?
Yeah, in his mid to late 30s.
Probably younger than I am now. Anyway, it was his birthday, which is July 4th, and we were doing our traditional thing. At that time, there was a family in our church that lived down on Prospect, and so they'd have a picnic, potluck thing, and we would stay and then watch the fireworks from there that were shot up over the river. And anyway, it was Dad's birthday, and it just hit me, and this isn't about Dad, I guess, it's about me and my dad, but it just hit me that he was getting older, and I started bawling. They brought the cake out and started singing to him. I just started bawling. My daddy's getting older, and someday he's not going to be here, I guess is what I was thinking. I just cried, and he just stood there and let me hold on to him and talked around me and just, you know, I don't think he quite knew what to do either, but I was just devastated.
At 11 years old?
Just devastated, yeah.
And now you're older than that, and you still have him, and he's kicking and going strong.
Oh, yeah. He's going stronger than I am, I think. I could tell you a more recent story.
Yeah, go say a more recent story.
Well, last Thursday, he came up, brought the table saw. I couldn't think of it. Came up and brought the table saw that his neighbor gave me. Mm-hmm. And we hung up pegboard and helped organize the shop some, and then about 1 o'clock, I gotta have a little bite to eat, and I'm about done because I hadn't been feeling great. And so he came in and we had a little bite to eat and visited a little bit, and then he came out and insisted on mowing the lawn. And I had to go lay down. I just couldn't be up anymore. He's like, I'm just gonna mow a little bit. That's when you guys came out, and he'd mowed this whole area and a little bit over there too, so. He's a good daddy. He's a good dad.
My dad lots of silly pictures sometimes. He really does.
He does?
And my mom and my dad both make up these silly things. Like, golly jeepers, what Dad made up, and then Mom made up another thing, but I can't remember the name of it.
What kind of pictures does he draw that are silly?
And he draws, like, these people that have, like, bug faces and stuff, with antennae, and so it's really silly.
Thanks.
The community gathered to celebrate John Dickinson's life and to mourn his passing. This next segment is Andrea Piron's eulogy at the huge community service in Moscow, Idaho.
Hey, John. Here we all are. We're building community and celebrating life together, just like you did every single day you were with us. You'd love it. Almost all your family is here and your friends. And guess what we've all been doing since you left? We've been talking to you.
Yeah.
Probably because you always listened. I know. It's almost as if you're God. You're probably loving it. We have so much to tell you. We have even more things to ask you. First of all, the play Touch that we put on, Sirius Idaho Theater. Thanks for bringing it to us. It was at a time when we were really struggling. We were struggling to make sense of the accident. We just couldn't believe the irony. We were producing a show about the disappearance of a woman right after you disappeared. It was the first time many of us got together after January 7th, and we had a great reception afterwards at the Red Door. You would have loved it. Hey, remember when Pam and you and I had our Sirius Idaho Theater retreat over at Mary Jane's farm? You said you wanted to bring plays to Moscow, which would start conversations in the community. Yeah, everything you ever strived for had that underlying goal, getting us to talk to each other and to listen to each other. You knew that was the foundation of a healthy community. If I had to pick one play that was just you, quintessentially you, John, it was Walk in the Woods. Yep, you were so ecstatic to play that Russian diplomat. You insisted on taking a walk with people in the woods and talking and listening and building friendship. That would be the answer to all the world's problems. You got to play yourself. You just loved it. And that stupid Russian accent, it drove us crazy. You wouldn't stop. You had to perfect it in every conversation. It was pretty funny. And that set you built for cow tipping and other signs of stress, oh my God. Holy cow. It was amazing. 7 doors. Remember Gregory Fletcher, the playwright from New York, said they wouldn't even build that kind of a set for an off-Broadway show. You know, that would run an entire season, and we ran the show 6 times. You never went to bed some nights. It was crazy. One of the things you loved most about the theater was when the people came on opening night. We'd be standing back in the sound booth and the light booth, and you'd say, Andriette, can I make the announcement again? Your excitement was palpable as you bounded down the aisle, ready to welcome the audience and thank them for being there. Yeah, you were right. You were funnier than me, too, so I gave it up pretty easily. That was just another way in which you solidified the community. Boy, John, you would have been so shocked when we had those shootings in Moscow. That was so hard. We needed you here. It took our breath away. 4 people dead. I suppose you've heard Bob left the city council. The good thing is Tom Lamar is running, so that's great. Yeah, you would probably help us with this campaign, at least if that's legal. I don't know if that would have been legal, but anyway. We missed you at Tom and Allie's wedding. Julie and I, we really wanted to dance with you. But we danced with each other instead. That was good, too. There's just a few things that I wanted to thank you for. Thanks for caring enough about Moscow to be our mediator councilman. Thanks for the stop sign on Mountain View. Thanks for making sure you left the Kenworthy just a little better than you found it after every play. Thanks for babysitting Ariana, my granddaughter, for free for a year, and for becoming part of our family. Thanks for becoming part of so many families. Thanks for going to the park with Ariana and I and Luke on our babysitting Tuesdays. Thanks for finding time in your day and space in your heart for all those conversations with all of us at the Red Door, at City Hall, at One World, the Silos, at the Food Co-op. I was at the Food Co-op the other day with Ariana, and she saw a blue Mini Cooper in the parking lot, and she said, "Omi, John's at the Food Co-op." And I had to explain to her one more time that you were gone. Thanks for being in Death of a Salesman at the U of I and going back to the U of I and touching so many people again there. Hey, and thanks for those practice dates with me. Those were fun. Remember on the third date you said, "Can I kiss you now?" And I said, "John, it's a practice date, remember? I have a boyfriend." And you said, "Andriette, I think I'm ready for a real date now." And thanks for finding Julie shortly after that. Yeah. We miss you. Bruce Gooch, the playwright for Random Acts of Love, sent a letter to us. And I'm going to read parts of it to you, John, just a small part. Because he's a writer, and he can capture what we all feel just so much better than I can. So this is from Bruce. "Your enthusiasm and commitment were arresting, simple, uncomplicated, and connected to you, the man, the human being that could not understand negativity, though you dealt with it. You, the man who would not settle for no. In the booth at the Kenworthy, you often had tears in your eyes and a smile on your face. I always thought the tears were for the story you were seeing realized, and the smile was for yourself, that you were right, that other people were moved by theater, that you knew that you were doing what you had to do. I hope that's what those smiles meant anyway. You became an event in my life, and I always believed from that event on you would be in my life until what, the end? What's that? I guess only you know. I feel blessed because the bond between us was just as unspoken and eternal as the ether of a performance on stage. And now I find it is eternal. Daily, almost, I see your fine white hair whipped with your frantic pace, a nearly imperceptible smile tugging at the corners of your mouth, brow set to fierce determination, and the innocence and kindness of your eyes shining on everything that crosses your aspect, making everything possible. I see that somehow, even with your physical absence no longer shackled to this earth, I have been blessed by your warmth, honest love, consideration, and goodwill. We all have. Everyone that met you has. And for that, we can all be grateful. It is a rare blessing from a rare man who never leaves us. We humbly thank you, John. See you tomorrow."
Scott High was a Yin Radio intern in 2007. The summer that he was interning, he and his girlfriend were having a baby. The morning that she was in labor, he turned in a piece for Yin Radio. Now that's dedication. This next segment is from Scott High. It's called Learning to Be a Dad.
"As I look forward to becoming a father, I have some time to reflect on the lessons my father taught me when I was growing up. I take the good and the bad and put them together to come up with ways I might teach my daughter while she is growing up. I think understanding how I was brought up by my father, I can have a clear image of what I can do in all the situations my daughter will go through. To understand how I was brought up, first you have to understand the area and time I was brought up in. I was born and raised in Twin Falls, Idaho. I've only moved once, and that was just down the street from where I used to live. Not a very challenging or long move. There was only one high school in my town. It was a place where everybody knew everybody and their business, whether they liked it or not. Kind of like Moscow. Having been the second generation of my family to live in Twin Falls, I wanted so much to get out on my own when I turned 18. The road to graduation and my 18th birthday was a long one, though. It took me a long time to figure out how I was raised and how much of that had an effect on how my dad was raised when he was young. My dad was born in Twin Falls in 1953. Although he did not live in Twin Falls at that time, Twin was the nearest town with a hospital that had the facilities for birth. He lived in a small town called Murtaugh, Idaho. When I say small, I mean small. This town had a grand population of 15 people, mostly farmers. He was one of four boys and a girl. He lived on a farm where he helped all of his older brothers and his father grow Idaho famous potatoes. I can even remember helping my grandmother and uncles pick potatoes when I was young. I will always remember my dad saying to me, "Son, you can do anything with a potato as long as you don't throw it away. Hell, you use it as a doorstop if you want." Yes, my family is crazy about potatoes. My grandfather was a very hard worker when it came to taking care of his farm. He could not do it forever, though. By the time he moved into Twin Falls, he had Alzheimer's, and he could not take care of the farm. By the time I was born and old enough to speak, I always saw my grandfather, but he never spoke to me because by that time he had forgotten how to speak. I never understood it at the age, and I still asked him all those questions I thought were important. I knew in some instances he could understand what I was saying by just looking at me and smiling. I always wish I could have known both of my grandfathers. My mom's dad, I wish I could have known, but he passed away when my mom was in high school. I still think his influence has been passed on to me through the lessons and stories my mom families tell me. I even still think he is around, still living, in his house. I would sometimes hear strange noises and footsteps in the middle of the night when I would stay at my grandmother's house. My mom always told me he did not like to have uninvited guests at his house, and all of my friends could contest to the strange noises when they would come visit. Both of my grandfathers came from very different backgrounds, one a farmer, the other a Navy signalman during World War II. Even though both passed away a long time, I still feel their influence passed on through my mother and father. The influence passed down was kind of an exploring self-influence. My grandfather never stressed to my father to be a farmer. Instead, he went off to U of I Law School and runs a law firm in Twin Falls now. My dad never stressed on me that I should be a lawyer, but the one thing both my mother and father did stress was school. Schooling has always been important in my family, as with everybody else, but my parents always told me it didn't matter what I did when I grew up, as long as I have completed college. I was never very good in high school, frankly, just because I did not care about anything. I think my best schooling experiences came when I entered the U of I. My dad felt the same way about his college, even though he went through three different colleges. Growing up, I would always pull little tricks on him because I just wanted him to laugh at me. My dad was always the stern one in the family, regulating everything I did. The one thing I loved was the fact that he trusted me even when I would get myself into trouble. When I would go out with my friends, I would test that by joking with him. Like any father, he would always want to know where I was going and what I was doing. Right before I would run out the door, in the most serious voice I can muster at the time, I would say something like, "I'm gonna go pick up a friend, probably rob someone, then buy lots of drugs with the score and drive home drunk, but I'll be home by 12. It was kind of my way of saying, "Dad, you can trust me. I'm not going to do anything stupid." He would just stare at me and say, "Okay, I'll see you in my office in the morning then. Have fun." He knew he would never see me sitting there in his office in the morning, but always was interested in what I actually did the night before. The one time I did actually test the theory, I was not robbing someone or doing drugs, but I was walking down the street a little late at night with my cousin. A cop stopped me and asked me what I was doing. He did not believe my story and ran my ID. Being as Twin as a small town, much like Moscow, he thought I was going to be rough with him or something and called backup on me. The next thing I know, I'm staring at eight cops with guns drawn. I think this was partially because he recognized my name and had a personal vendetta against my father. It was summer, and one of those nights where it was 90 degrees and all I was doing was walking down the street. Southern Idaho has this mentality that all teenagers must be hard felons and every teen must be locked up for the rest of their life, especially in Twin Falls. I can see why my dad was a little paranoid about what I was doing at nights with my friends. 8 cops against 2 16-year-old teenagers who were out past the town curfew. A little strange, I think. After I told my dad what happened, he just looked at me like, you see what happens in this town? Now you know why I ask you where you're going every time you go out. As every teenager should, I rebelled against my parents just a little bit. My dad was always one step ahead of me, though. When my parents would go out of town for the weekend, he would hide all of his liquor bottles so I would not get into them. I always knew where he hid them, and when the opportunity would arise to throw a party, I would not let anyone else know. For my senior year of high school, my parents conveniently left me alone during graduation weekend to go on a business trip back east. I threw a huge graduation party. My sister was always looking out for the best interests of my parents, and I drove her absolutely insane during that time. By the time my parents got back, I knew they knew I did something because the house was in better shape than before they left. My dad was walking around in the backyard, and he stopped, bent over, and picked up a beer bottle cap I had forgotten about. He just looked at me and said, "You missed one, bud." I knew then that no matter what I did, I could not possibly pass one over my parents. He was not mad at me. He understood. I was graduating high school. What else is a teenager going to do when their parents leave at the perfect opportunity to throw a party? No matter how hard parents try, they're just going to do it anyways. My dad accepted this fate and knew all along what I was doing. His only concern was that no one left my house drunk and no one broke anything major. With all the silly tricks and things I did to give my dad gray hairs, I'm sure my daughter will do the same to me as she gets older. I'm grateful for all the things my dad has directly taught me and indirectly taught me. Looking back at all the lessons I have learned, I feel confident and prepared to be a father.
We all experience death in our own way. Our awareness is heightened as things seem to slow down. We capture details that normally would elude us. Other details and plans for the future elude us completely. I woke up this morning before the alarm went off to raise me from my bed for my flight home. I gave my dog her morning pets. She rolled over to get belly scratches. As I cuddled my sweet, quiet puppy, I assumed Daddy was still alive since I hadn't received a call in the middle of the night, but I couldn't be sure. The sun was just starting to shine through the window, just over the horizon, bright and clear. I walked into the living room. The entire room was glowing a deep, rich red light. Magical light, created by shiny red curtains throwing the sunlight around the room. 3,000 miles away, Dad was sleeping, breathing more shallowly, occasionally skipping a breath. His wife, Pat, his kids, Susan, Sherry, and Jamie, were in the room, noting the changes. Probably holding his hand, maybe talking to him a bit. Just being with him and being together. I stepped outside, into the sun. The frost was really thick on the deck, thicker than it's been in days. The glass window by the hot tub was white in the new morning sun, and the hot tub cover had a layer of frost, probably a full quarter of an inch thick. Where the sun hit the chair, the ice had already bubbled into little pools of water. Soon the frost layer would melt and evaporate with the growing day. The stillness of the morning, even with a steady breeze, matched my peace of mind. I thought of Dad in his hospital bed in Florida as I turned to see the young day's sun. Too bright to look into, too bright to see into the yard. I turned my back to the sun and watched my shadow on the house, saw the brightness of the day, the blue of the sky, and thought, it's a good day. It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to live. Dad quit breathing then. The night before, Sherry called to tell me they were going to let Daddy go. He hated the oxygen mask he needed to keep breathing through his morphine-induced sleep. He needed the morphine for his terrible, moan-inducing headaches, but his blood pressure was too low for him to be given morphine without risk. He was agitated, he was belligerent, and he was generally unhappy and in pain. As she was telling me and sobbing, I thought I heard his voice in the background. She said he was snoring. With a little laugh, I asked her to hold the phone out so I could hear him snore. What I heard instead was loud moans from him and Pat, his wife of 35 years, telling him he'll feel better in 6 minutes. 6 minutes, Ed. Sherry said to him, "Sandy says she loves you." Dad heard her. He said, "I love you." I knew it was the last time I'd hear his voice. I spent the evening with distractions, having already packed, collected photos, and found the music I wanted for him. After dinner out, a couple of drinks toasted to his silly nickname, Eddie Joe Bullet, I was sleepy from tears and ready for bed. I stepped outside and saw the clear, bright stars. I faced the sky and sang to Dad the song, an Indigo Girls tune, one that I thought he needed and would like. Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. And it continues, no feet to fall, you need no ground. Now you glide right through the sun. Released from circles, guarded skies, now we all are chosen ones. Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. After admiring the red living room, the sun, and the frost, I went inside and got dressed for my travels, brushed my teeth. It was 6:58, and I was just going to wake my roommate who was driving me to the airport. My cell phone rang. On the display it said, Sherry's cell. Knowing why she was calling, I said, "Hi, Sherry." She told me Dad passed, peacefully, 15 minutes ago. She was there, they all were, all night, noting that his breathing shallowed, then stopped. Then he'd take another breath. He'd always surprise us, she said. But then he stopped for good. Just as I was looking at the sun, the frost, the good day, and feeling like things were all right. There are many things that are inexorably linked with Daddy for me. Carousels, box kites, Christmas, peanut brittle ice cream, tandem bicycles, drinking milk from the jug, bacon. Now add to that list. I'll always think of Dad when the living room is deep red and outside the frost is thick and sparkling in the new morning. Background music comes from Evissa Salinas. It's a piece called Father Spirit from her album Adieu. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program, or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week. Eddie Joe Bullitt, my dad, Ed Billings.
Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun.